as he never sent me anything until you showed up, says Peeta. I haven't thought much about this. How it must have looked from Peeta's perspective when I appeared in the arena, having received burn medicine and bread, when he, who was at death's door, had gotten nothing, like Haymitch was keeping me alive at his expense.
Look, boy, Haymitch begins. Don't bother, Haymitch. I know you had to choose one of us, and I'd have wanted it to be her. But this is something different. People are dead out there. More will follow unless we are very good.
We all know I'm better than Katniss in front of the cameras.
No one needs to coach me on what to say, but I have to know what I'm walking into, says Peeta. From now on, you'll be fully informed, Haymitch promises. I better be, says Peeta.
He doesn't even bother to look at me before he leaves. The dust he disrupted billows up and looks for new places to land. My hair, my eyes, my shiny gold pin. Did you choose me, Haymitch? I ask.
Yeah, he says.
Why? You like him better, I say.
That's true. But remember, until they change the rules, I could only hope to get one of you out of there alive, he says. I thought since he was determined to protect you, well, between the three of us, we might be able to bring you home.
Oh, is all I can think to say.
You'll see. The choices you'll have to make, if we survive this, says Haymitch. You'll learn.
Well, I've learned one thing today. This place is not a larger version of District 12. Our fence is unguarded and rarely charged. Our peacekeepers are unwelcome but less brutal. Our hardships evoke more fatigue than fury. Here in 11, they suffer more acutely and feel more desperation. President Snow is right. A spark could be enough to set them ablaze. Everything is happening too fast for me to process it. The warning, the shootings, the recognition that I may have set something of great consequence in motion. The whole thing is so improbable. And it would be one thing if I had planned to stir things up, but given the circumstances, how on earth did I cause so much trouble?
Come on, we've got a dinner to attend, says Haymitch.
I stand in the shower as long as they let me, before I have to come out to be readied. The prep team seems oblivious to the events of the day. They're all excited about the dinner. In the districts, they're important enough to attend, whereas back in the capital, they almost never score invitations to prestigious parties. While they try to predict what dishes will be served, I keep seeing the old man's head being blown off. I don't even pay attention to what anyone is doing to me until I'm about to leave and I see myself in the mirror. A pale pink strapless dress brushes my shoes. My hair is pinned back from my face and falling down my back in a shower of ringlets. Cinna comes up behind me and arranges a shimmering silver wrap around my shoulders. He catches my eye in the mirror.
Like it?
It's beautiful, as always, I say.
Let's see how it looks with a smile, he says gently.
It's his reminder that in a minute there will be cameras again. I manage to raise the corners of my lips.
There we go.
When we all assemble to go down to the dinner, I can see Effie is out of sorts. Surely Haymitch hasn't told her about what happened in the square. I wouldn't be surprised if Cinna and Portia know, but there seems to be an unspoken agreement to leave Effie out of the bad news loop. It doesn't take long to hear about the problem, though. Effie runs through the evening schedule, then tosses it aside.
And then, thank goodness, we can all get on that train and get out of here, she says.
Is something wrong, Effie? Asks Cinna.
I don't like the way we've been treated. being stuffed into trucks and barred from the platform. And then, but an hour ago, I decided to look around the Justice Building. I'm something of an expert in architectural design, you know, she says.
Oh, yes, I've heard that, says Portia before the pause gets too long.
So I was just having a peek around because district ruins are going to be all the rage this year, when two peacemakers showed up and ordered me back to our quarters. One of them actually poked me with her gun, says Effie.
I can't help thinking this is the direct result of Hamish, Peter, and me disappearing earlier in the day. It's a little reassuring, actually, to think that Hamish might have been right, that no one would have been monitoring the dusty dome where we talked. Although, I bet they are now.
Effie looks so distressed that I spontaneously give her a hug.
That's awful, Effie. Maybe we shouldn't go to the dinner at all, at least until they've apologized.
I know she'll never agree to this, but she brightens considerably at the suggestion, at the validation of her complaint.
No, I'll manage. It's part of my job to weather the ups and downs. And we can't let you two miss your dinner, she says. But thank you for the offer, Katniss.
Effie arranges us in formation for our entrance. First the prep teams, then her, the stylists, Hamish. Peter and I, of course, bring up the rear. Somewhere below, musicians begin to play. As the first wave of our little procession begins down the steps, Peter and I join hands.
Hamish says I was wrong to yell at you. You were only operating under his instructions, says Peter. And it isn't as if I haven't kept things from you in the past.
I remember the shock of hearing Peter confess his love for me in front of all of Panem. Hamish had known about that and not told me. I think I broke a few things myself after that interview.
Just an urn, he says.
And your hands. There's no point to it any more, though, is there? Not being straight with each other, I say.
No point, says Peter.
We stand at the top of the stairs, giving Hamish a 15-step lead as Effie directed.
Was that really the only time you kissed Gale?
I'm so startled, I answer, yes. With all that has happened today, has that question actually been preying on him?
That's 15. Let's do it, he says.
A light hits us, and I put on the most dazzling smile I can. We descend the steps and are sucked into what becomes an indistinguishable round of dinners, ceremonies, and train rides. Each day it's the same. Wake up, get dressed, ride through cheering crowds. Listen to a speech in our honor, give a thank you speech in return, but only the one the Capitol gave us. Never any personal additions now. Sometimes a brief tour, a glimpse of the sea in one district, towering forests in another, ugly factories, fields of wheat, stinking refineries. Dress in evening clothes, attend dinner, train. During ceremonies we are solemn and respectful, but always linked together by our hands, our arms. At dinners, we are borderline delirious in our love for each other. We kiss, we dance, we get caught trying to sneak away to be alone. On the train, we are quietly miserable as we try to assess what effect we might be having. Even without our personal speeches to trigger dissent, needless to say, the ones we gave in District 11 were edited out before the event was broadcast. You can feel something in the air. The rolling boil of a pot about to run over. Not everywhere. Some crowds have the weary cattle feel that I know District 12 usually projects at the victors' ceremonies. But in others, particularly 8, 4, and 3, there is a genuine elation in the faces of the people at the sight of us, and under the elation, fury. When they chant my name, it is more of a cry for vengeance than a cheer. When the peacekeepers move in to quiet an unruly crowd, it presses back instead of retreating. And I know that there's nothing I could ever do to change this. No show of love, however believable, will turn this tide. If my holding out those berries was an act of temporary insanity, then these people will embrace insanity too. Cinna begins to take in my clothes around the waist. The prep team frets over the circles under my eyes. Effie starts giving me pills to sleep, but they don't work. Not well enough. I drift off only to be roused by nightmares that have increased in number and intensity. Peter, who spends much of the night roaming the train, hears me screaming as I struggle to break out of the haze of drugs that merely prolong the horrible dreams. He manages to wake me and calm me down. Then he climbs into bed to hold me until I fall back to sleep. After that, I refuse the pills, but every night I let him into my bed. We manage the darkness as we did in the arena, wrapped in each other's arms, guarding against dangers that can descend at any moment. Nothing else happens, but our arrangement quickly becomes a subject of gossip on the train. When Effie brings it up to me, I think, good, maybe it will get back to President Snow. I tell her we'll make an effort to be more discreet, but we don't. The back-to-back appearances in 2 and 1 are their own special kind of awful. Cato and Clove, the tributes from District 2, might have both made it home if Peter and I hadn't. I personally killed the girl, Glimmer, and the boy from District 1. As I tried to avoid looking at his family, I learned that his name was Marvel. How did I never know that? I suppose that before the games I didn't pay attention, and afterward I didn't want to know. By the time we reach the capital, we are desperate. We make endless appearances to adoring crowds. There is no danger of an uprising here among the privileged, among those whose names are never placed in the reaping balls, whose children never die for the supposed crimes committed generations ago. We don't need to convince anybody in the capital of our love, but hold to the slim hope that we can still reach some of those we failed to convince in the districts. Whatever we do seems too little, too late. Back in our old quarters in the training center, I'm the one who suggests the public marriage proposal. Peter agrees to do it, but then disappears to his room for a long time. Hamish tells me to leave him alone. I thought he wanted it anyway, I say. Not like this, Hamish says. He wanted it to be real. I go back to my room and lie under the covers, trying not to think of Gale, and thinking of nothing else. That night, on the stage before the training center, we bubble our way through a list of questions. Caesar Flickerman, in his twinkling midnight blue suit, his hair, eyelids, and lips still dyed powder blue, flawlessly guides us through the interview. When he asks us about the future, Peter gets down on one knee, pours out his heart, and begs me to marry him. I, of course, accept. Caesar is beside himself. The capital audience is hysterical. Shots of crowds around Panem show a country besotted with happiness. President Snow himself makes a surprise visit to congratulate us. He clasps Peter's hand and gives him an approving slap on the shoulder. He embraces me, enfolding me in the smell of blood and roses, and plants a puffy kiss on my cheek. When he pulls back, his fingers digging into my arms, his face smiling into mine, I dare to raise my eyebrows. They ask what my lips can't. Did I do it? Was it enough? Was giving everything over to you, keeping up the game, promising to marry Peter, enough? In answer, he gives an almost imperceptible shake of his head.
Chapter 6. In that one slight motion, I see the end of hope, the beginning of the destruction of everything I hold dear in the world. I can't guess what form my punishment will take, how wide the net will be cast, but when it is finished, there will most likely be nothing left. So you would think that at this moment I would be in utter despair. Here's what's strange. The main thing I feel is a sense of relief, that I can give up this game, that the question of whether I can succeed in this venture has been answered, even if that answer is a resounding no, that if desperate times call for desperate measures, then I am free to act as desperately as I wish. Only not here. Not quite yet. It's essential to get back to District 12, because the main part of any plan will include my mother and sister, Gail and his family, and Peter, if I can get him to come with us. I add Haymitch to the list. These are the people I must take with me when I escape into the wild. How I will convince them where we will go in the dead of winter, what it will take to evade capture, are unanswered questions. But at least now I know what I must do. So instead of crumpling to the ground and weeping, I find myself standing up straighter and with more confidence than I have in weeks. My smile, while somewhat insane, is not forced. And when President Snow silences the audience and says, "What do you think about us throwing them a wedding right here in the Capitol?" I pull off girl almost catatonic with joy without a hitch. Caesar Flickerman asks if the president has a date in mind.
"Oh, before we set a date, we better clear it with Katniss's mother," says the president.
The audience gives a big laugh, and the president puts his arm around me.
"Maybe if the whole country puts its mind to it, we can get you married before you're 30.
"You'll probably have to pass a new law," I say with a giggle.
"If that's what it takes," says the president with conspiratorial good humor. Oh, the fun we two have together.
The party, held in the banquet room of President Snow's mansion, has no equal. The 40-foot ceiling has been transformed into the night sky, and the stars look exactly as they do at home. I suppose they look the same from the Capitol, but who would know? There's always too much light from the city to see the stars here. About halfway between the floor and the ceiling, musicians float on what look like fluffy white clouds, but I can't see what holds them aloft. Traditional dining tables have been replaced by innumerable stuffed sofas and chairs, some surrounding fireplaces, others beside fragrant flower gardens or ponds filled with exotic fish, so that people can eat and drink and do whatever they please in the utmost comfort. There's a large tiled area in the center of the room that serves as everything from a dance floor to a stage for the performers who come and go, to another spot to mingle with the flamboyantly dressed guests. But the real star of the evening is the food. Tables laden with delicacies line the walls. Everything you can think of, and things you have never dreamed of, lie in wait. Whole roasted cows and pigs and goats still turning on spits. Huge platters of fowl stuffed with savory fruits and nuts. Ocean creatures drizzled in sauces or begging to be dipped in spicy concoctions. Countless cheeses, breads, vegetables, sweets, waterfalls of wine, and streams of spirits that flicker with flames. My appetite has returned with my desire to fight back. After weeks of feeling too worried to eat, I'm famished. "I want to taste everything in the room," I tell Peter. I can see him trying to read my expression, to figure out my transformation.
Since he doesn't know that President Snow thinks I have failed, he can only assume that I think we have succeeded. Perhaps even that I have some genuine happiness at our engagement. His eyes reflect his puzzlement, but only briefly, because we're on camera.
Then you'd better pace yourself, he says.
Okay, no more than one bite of each dish, I say. My resolve is almost immediately broken at the first table, which has 20 or so soups, when I encounter a creamy pumpkin brew sprinkled with slivered nuts and tiny black seeds. I could just eat this all night, I exclaim. But I don't. I weaken again at a clear green broth that I can only describe as tasting like springtime, and again when I try a frothy pink soup dotted with raspberries. Faces appear, names are exchanged, pictures taken, kisses brushed on cheeks. Apparently my Mockingjay pin has spawned a new fashion sensation, because several people come up to show me their accessories. My bird has been replicated on belt buckles, embroidered into silk lapels, even tattooed in intimate places. Everyone wants to wear the winner's token. I can only imagine how nuts that makes President Snow. But what can he do? The games were such a hit here, where the berries were only a symbol of a desperate girl trying to save her lover. Peter and I make no effort to find company, but are constantly sought out. We are what no one wants to miss at the party. I act delighted, but I have zero interest in these capital people. They are only distractions from the food. Every table presents new temptations, and even on my restricted one-taste-per-dish regimen, I begin filling up quickly. I pick up a small roasted bird and bite into it, and my tongue floods with orange sauce. Delicious. But I make Peter eat the remainder because I want to keep tasting things and the idea of throwing away food, as I see so many people doing so casually, is abhorrent to me. After about 10 tables, I'm stuffed, and we've only sampled a small number of the dishes available. Just then, my prep team descends on us. They're nearly incoherent between the alcohol they've consumed and their ecstasy at being at such a grand affair.
"What aren't you eating?"
asks Octavia. "I have been, but I can't hold another bite," I say. They all laugh as if that's the silliest thing they've ever heard.
"No one lets that stop them," says Flavius.
They lead us over to a table that holds tiny-stemmed wine glasses filled with clear liquid.
"Drink this."
Peter picks one up to take a sip, and they lose it.
"Not here," shrieks Octavia.
"You have to do it in there,"
says Venia, pointing to a door that leads to the toilets.
"Or you'll get it all over the floor."
Peter looks at the glass again and puts it together.
"You mean this will make me puke?"
My prep team laughs hysterically.
"Of course, so you can keep eating," says Octavia. "I've been in there twice already. Everyone does it, or else how would you have any fun at a feast?"
I'm speechless, staring at the pretty little glasses and all they imply. Peter sets his back on the table with such precision, you'd think it might detonate. "Come on, Katniss, let's dance." Music filters down from the clouds as he leads me away from the team, the table, and out onto the floor. We know only a few dances at home, the kind that go with fiddle and flute music and require a good deal of space. But Effie has shown us some that are popular in the capital. The music's slow and dreamlike, so Peter pulls me into his arms and we move in a circle with practically no steps at all. You could do this dance on a pie plate. We're quiet for a while. Then Peter speaks in a strained voice. You go along, thinking you can deal with it, thinking maybe they're not so bad, and then you...
He cuts himself off. All I can think of is the emaciated bodies of the children on our kitchen table as my mother prescribes what the parents can't give. More food. Now that we're rich, she'll send some home with them. But often in the old days, there was nothing to give, and the child was past saving anyway. And here in the capital, they're vomiting for the pleasure of filling their bellies again and again. Not from some illness of body or mind. Not from spoiled food. It's what everyone does at a party. Expected, part of the fun. One day when I dropped by to give Hazel the game, Vic was homesick with a bad cough. Being part of Gail's family, the kid has to eat better than 90% of the rest of District 12. But he still spent about 15 minutes talking about how they'd open a can of corn syrup from parcel day and each had a spoonful on bread and were going to maybe have more later in the week. How Hazel had said he could have a bit in a cup of tea to soothe his cough, but he wouldn't feel right unless the others had some too. If it's like that at Gale's, what's it like in the other houses? Peter, they bring us here to fight to the death for their entertainment, I say. Really, this is nothing by comparison.
I know that. It's just sometimes I can't stand it anymore, to the point where I'm not sure what I'll do.
He pauses, then whispers,
Maybe we were wrong, Katniss.
About what? I ask.
About trying to subdue things in the districts, he says.
My head turns swiftly from side to side, but no one seems to have heard. The camera crew got sidetracked at a table of shellfish, and the couples dancing around us are either too drunk or too self-involved to notice.
Sorry, he says.
He should be. This is no place to be voicing such thoughts.
Save it for home, I tell him.
Just then, Portia appears with a large man who looks vaguely familiar. She introduces him as Plutarch Heavensby, the new head game maker. Plutarch asks Peter if he can steal me for a dance. Peter's recovered his camera face and good-naturedly passes me over, warning the man not to get too attached. I don't want to dance with Plutarch Heavensby. I don't want to feel his hands, one resting against mine, one on my hip. I'm not used to being touched, except by Peter or my family, and I rank game makers somewhere below maggots in terms of creatures I want in contact with my skin. But he seems to sense this and holds me almost at arm's length as we turn on the floor. We chit-chat about the party, about the entertainment, about the food. And then he makes a joke about avoiding punch since training. I don't get it, and then I realize he's the man who tripped backward into the punch bowl when I shot an arrow at the game makers during the training session. Well, not really. I was shooting an apple out of their roast pig's mouth. But I made them jump.
Oh, you're the one who...
I laugh, remembering him splashing back into the punch bowl.
Yes. And you'll be pleased to know I've never recovered, says Plutarch.
I want to point out that 22 dead tributes will never recover from the games he helped create, either. But I only say,
Good, so you're the head game maker this year.
That must be a big honor.
Between you and me? There weren't many takers for the job, he says.
So much responsibility as to how the games turn out. Yeah, the last guy's dead, I think. He must know about Seneca Crane, but he doesn't look the least bit concerned. Are you planning the Quarter Quell games already? I say.
Oh, yes. Well, they've been in the works for years, of course. Arenas aren't built in a day.
But the, shall we say, flavor of the games is being determined now. Believe it or not, I've got a strategy meeting tonight, he says. Plutarch steps back and pulls out a gold watch on a chain from a vest pocket. He flips open the lid, sees the time, and frowns. I'll have to be going soon. He turns the watch so I can see the face. It starts at midnight. That seems late for, I say, but then something distracts me. Plutarch has run his thumb across the crystal face of the watch, and for just a moment an image appears, glowing as if lit by candlelight. It's another mockingjay, exactly like the pin on my dress. Only this one disappears. He snaps the watch closed. That's very pretty, I say.
Oh, it's more than pretty. It's one of a kind, he says.
If anyone asks about me, say I've gone home to bed. The meetings are supposed to be kept secret. But I thought it'd be safe to tell you. Yes, your secret's safe with me, I say. As we shake hands, he gives a small bow, a common gesture here in the capital. Well, I'll see you next summer at the games, Katniss. Best wishes on your engagement and good luck with your mother. I'll need it, I say. Plutarch disappears, and I wander through the crowd looking for Peter. As strangers congratulate me on my engagement, on my victory at the games, on my choice of lipstick. I respond, but really I'm thinking about Plutarch showing off his pretty one-of-a-kind watch to me. There was something strange about it, almost clandestine. But why? Maybe he thinks someone else will steal his idea of putting a disappearing mockingjay on a watch face. Yes, he probably paid a fortune for it, and now he can't show it to anyone because he's afraid someone will make a cheap knockoff version. Only in the capital. I find Peter admiring a table of elaborately decorated cakes. Bakers have come in from the kitchen especially to talk frosting with him, and you can see them tripping over one another to answer his questions. At his request, they assemble an assortment of little cakes for him to take back to District 12, where he can examine their work in quiet. Effie said we have to be on the train at 1. I wonder what time it is, he says, glancing around. Almost midnight, I reply. I pluck a chocolate flower from a cake with my fingers and nibble on it, so beyond worrying about manners. Time to say thank you and farewell, trills Effie at my elbow. It's one of those moments when I just love her compulsive punctuality. We collect Cinna and Portia, and she escorts us around to say goodbye to important people, then herds us to the door. Shouldn't we thank President Snow? Asks Peter. It's his house. Oh, he's not a big one for parties. Too busy, says Effie. I've already arranged for the necessary notes and gifts to be sent to him tomorrow. There you are! Effie gives a little wave to two capital attendants, who have an inebriated Haymitch propped up between them. We travel through the streets of the capital in a car with darkened windows. Behind us, another car brings the prep teams. The throngs of people celebrating are so thick, it's slow going. But Effie has this all down to a science, and at exactly 1 o'clock we are back on the train, and it's pulling out of the station. Haymitch is deposited in his room. Cinna orders tea, and we all take seats around the table while Effie rattles her schedule papers and reminds us we're still on tour. There's the Harvest Festival in District 12 to think about, so I suggest we drink our tea and head straight to bed. No one argues. When I open my eyes, it's early afternoon. My head rests on Peter's arm. I don't remember him coming in last night. I turn, being careful not to disturb him, but he's already awake. No nightmares, he says. What? I ask. You didn't have any nightmares last night, he says. He's right. For the first time in ages, I've slept through the night.
I had a dream, though, I say, thinking back. I was following a mockingjay through the woods for a long time. It was Rue, really. I mean, when it sang, it had her voice.
Where did she take you? He says, brushing my hair off my forehead.
I don't know. We never arrived, I say, but I felt happy.
Well, you slept like you were happy, he says.
Peter, how come I never know when you're having a nightmare? I say.
I don't know. I don't think I cry out or thrash around or anything. I just come to paralyzed with terror, he says.
You should wake me, I say, thinking about how I can interrupt his sleep 2 or 3 times on a bad night, about how long it can take to calm me down.
It's not necessary. My nightmares are usually about losing you, he says. I'm okay, once I realize you're here.
Ugh. Peter makes comments like this in such an offhand way, and it's like being hit in the gut. He's only answering my question honestly. He's not pressing me to reply in kind, to make any declaration of love, but I still feel awful, as if I've been using him in some terrible way. Have I? I don't know. I only know that for the first time, I feel immoral about him being here in my bed, which is ironic, since we're officially engaged now.
Be worse when we're home and I'm sleeping alone again, he says.
That's right. We're almost home.
The agenda for District 12 includes a dinner at Mayor Undersea's house tonight and a victory rally in the square during the Harvest Festival tomorrow. We always celebrate the Harvest Festival on the final day of the victory tour, but usually it means a meal at home or with a few friends if you can afford it. This year it will be a public affair, and since the capital will be throwing it, everyone in the whole district will have full bellies. Most of our prepping will take place at the mayor's house, since we're back to being covered in furs for outdoor appearances. We're only at the train station briefly, to smile and wave as we pile into our car. We don't even get to see our families until the dinner tonight. I'm glad it will be at the mayor's house instead of at the Justice Building, where the memorial for my father was held, where they took me after the reaping for those wrenching goodbyes to my family. The Justice Building is too full of sadness. But I like Mayor Undersea's house, especially now that his daughter Madge and I are friends. We always were, in a way. It became official when she came to say goodbye to me before I left for the games, when she gave me the Mockingjay pin for luck. After I got home, we started spending time together. It turns out Madge has plenty of empty hours to fill, too. It was a little awkward at first because we didn't know what to do. Other girls our age, I've heard them talking about boys or other girls or clothes. Madge and I aren't gossipy, and clothes bore me to tears. But after a few false starts, I realized she was dying to go into the woods, so I've taken her a couple of times and showed her how to shoot. She's trying to teach me the piano, but mostly I like to listen to her play. Sometimes we eat at each other's houses. Madge likes mine better. Her parents seem nice, but I don't think she sees a whole lot of them. Her father has District 12 to run, and her mother gets fierce headaches that force her to stay in bed for days. Maybe you should take her to the Capitol, I said during one of them. We weren't playing the piano that day, because even 2 floors away the sound caused her mother pain. They can fix her up, I bet.
Yes, but you don't go to the Capitol unless they invite you, said Madge unhappily.
Even the mayor's privileges are limited.
When we reach the mayor's house, I only have time to give Madge a quick hug before Effie hustles me off to the 3rd floor to get ready. After I'm prepped and dressed in a full-length silver gown,
I've still got an hour to kill before the dinner, so I slip off to find her. Madge's bedroom is on the second floor, along with several guest rooms and her father's study. I stick my head in the study to say hello to the mayor, but it's empty. The television's droning on, and I stop to watch shots of Peter and me at the Capitol party last night, dancing, eating, kissing. This will be playing in every household in Panem right now. The audience must be sick to death of the star-crossed lovers from District 12. I know I am. I'm leaving the room when a beeping noise catches my attention. I turn back to see the screen of the television go black. Then the words, "Update on District 8," start flashing. Instinctively, I know this is not for my eyes, but something intended only for the mayor. I should go, quickly. Instead, I find myself stepping closer to the television. An announcer I've never seen before appears. It's a woman with graying hair and a hoarse, authoritative voice. She warns that conditions are worsening and a level 3 alert has been called. Additional forces are being sent into District 8 and all textile production has ceased. They cut away from the woman to the main square in District 8. I recognize it because I was there only last week. There are still banners with my face waving from the rooftops. Below them, there's a mob scene. The square's packed with screaming people, their faces hidden with rags and homemade masks, throwing bricks. Buildings burn. Peacekeepers shoot into the crowd, killing at random. I've never seen anything like it. But I can only be witnessing one thing. This is what President Snow calls an uprising.
Chapter 7.
A leather bag filled with food and a flask of hot tea. A pair of fur-lined gloves that Cinna left behind. 3 twigs, broken from the naked trees, lying in the snow, pointing in the direction I will travel. This is what I leave for Gale at our usual meeting place on the first Sunday after the Harvest Festival. I have continued on through the cold, misty woods, breaking a path that will be unfamiliar to Gale, but is simple for my feet to find. It leads to the lake. I no longer trust that our regular rendezvous spot offers privacy, and I'll need that and more to spill my guts to Gale today. But will he even come? If he doesn't, I'll have no choice but to risk going to his house in the dead of night. There are things he has to know, things I need him to help me figure out. Once the implications of what I was seeing on Mayor Undersea's television hit me, I made for the door and started down the hall. Just in time, too, because the mayor came up the steps moments later. I gave him a wave.
"Looking for Madge?" he said in a friendly tone.
"Yes, I want to show her my dress," I said.
"Well, you know where to find her."
Just then, another round of beeping came from his study. His face turned grave.
"Excuse me," he said.
He went into his study and closed the door tightly. I waited in the hall until I had composed myself, reminded myself I must act naturally. Then I found Madge in her room, sitting at her dressing table, brushing out her wavy blonde hair before a mirror. She was in the same pretty white dress she'd worn on reaping day. She saw my reflection behind her and smiled. "Look at you! Like you came right off the streets of the Capitol." I stepped in closer. My fingers touched the mockingjay. "Even my pin now. Mockingjays are all the rage in the Capitol, thanks to you." "Are you sure you don't want it back?" I asked.
"Don't be silly. It was a gift," said Madge.
She tied back her hair in a festive gold ribbon.
"Where did you get it anyway?" I asked.
"It was my aunt's," she said. "But I think it's been in the family a long time."
"It's a funny choice, a mockingjay," I said. "I mean, because of what happened in the rebellion." with the Jabberjays backfiring on the Capitol and all. The Jabberjays were mutations, genetically enhanced male birds created by the Capitol as weapons to spy on rebels in the districts. They could remember and repeat long passages of human speech, so they were sent into rebel areas to capture our words and return them to the Capitol. The rebels caught on and turned them against the Capitol by sending them home loaded with lies. When this was discovered, the Jabberjays were left to die. In a few years, they became extinct in the wild, but not before they had mated with female mockingbirds, creating an entirely new species.
But mockingjays were never a weapon, said Madge. They're just songbirds, right?
Yeah, I guess so, I said. But it's not true. A mockingbird is just a songbird. A mockingjay is a creature the Capitol never intended to exist. They hadn't counted on the highly controlled Jabberjay having the brains to adapt to the wild, to pass on its genetic code, to thrive in a new form. They hadn't anticipated its will to live. Now, as I trudge through the snow, I see the mockingjays hopping about on branches as they pick up on other birds' melodies, replicate them, and then transform them into something new. As always, they remind me of Rue. I think of the dream I had the last night on the train, where I followed her in mockingjay form. I wish I could have stayed asleep just a bit longer and found out where she was trying to take me. It's a hike to the lake, no question. If he decides to follow me at all, Gale's going to be put out by this excessive use of energy that could be better spent in hunting. He was conspicuously absent from the dinner at the mayor's house, although the rest of his family came. Hazel said he was homesick, which was an obvious lie. I couldn't find him at the harvest festival either. Vic told me he was out hunting. That was probably true. After a couple of hours, I reach an old house near the edge of the lake. Maybe house is too big a word for it. It's only one room, about 12 feet square. My father thought that a long time ago there were a lot of buildings. You can still see some of the foundations, and people came to them to play and fish in the lake. This house outlasted the others because it's made of concrete. Floor, roof, ceiling. Only one of 4 glass windows remains, wavy and yellowed by time. There's no plumbing and no electricity, but the fireplace still works, and there's a woodpile in the corner that my father and I collected years ago. I start a small fire, counting on the mist to obscure any telltale smoke. While the fire catches, I sweep out the snow that has accumulated under the empty windows, using a twig broom my father made me when I was about 8, and I played house here. Then I sit on the tiny concrete hearth, thawing out by the fire and waiting for Gale. It's a surprisingly short time before he appears. A bow slung over his shoulder, a dead wild turkey he must have encountered along the way hanging from his belt. He stands in the doorway as if considering whether or not to enter. He holds the unopened leather bag of food, the flask, Cinna's gloves, gifts he will not accept because of his anger at me. I know exactly how he feels. Didn't I do the same thing to my mother? I look in his eyes. His temper can't quite mask the hurt, the sense of betrayal he feels at my engagement to Peter. This will be my last chance, this meeting today, to not lose Gale forever. I could take hours trying to explain, and even then have him refuse me. Instead, I go straight to the heart of my defense. President Snow personally threatened to have you killed, I say. Gale raises his eyebrows slightly, but there's no real show of fear or astonishment.
Anyone else?
Well, he didn't actually give me a copy of the list, but it's a good guess it includes both our families, I say. It's enough to bring him to the fire. He crouches before the hearth and warms himself.
Unless what?
Unless nothing now, I say. Obviously, this requires more of an explanation, but I have no idea where to start, so I just sit there staring gloomily into the fire. After about a minute of this, Gale breaks the silence.
Well, thanks for the heads up.
I turn to him, ready to snap, but I catch the glint in his eye. I hate myself for smiling. This is not a funny moment, but I guess it's a lot to drop on someone.
We're all going to be obliterated no matter what.
I do have a plan, you know.
Yeah, I bet it's a stunner, he says.
He tosses the gloves on my lap.
Here, I don't want your fiancé's old gloves.
He's not my fiancé. That's just part of the act. And these aren't his gloves. They were Cinna's, I say.
Give them back then, he says.
He pulls on the gloves, flexes his fingers, and nods in approval.
At least I'll die in comfort.
That's optimistic. Of course, you don't know what's happened, I say.
Let's have it,
he says. I decide to begin with the night Peeta and I were crowned victors at the Hunger Games, and Haymitch warned me of the capital's fury. I tell him about the uneasiness that dogged me even once I was back home, President Snow's visit to my house, the murders in District 11, the tension in the crowds, the last-ditch effort of the engagement, the president's indication that it hadn't been enough, my certainty that I'll have to pay. Gale never interrupts. While I talk, he tucks the gloves in his pocket and occupies himself with turning the food in the leather bag into a meal for us. Toasting bread and cheese, coring apples, placing chestnuts in the fire to roast. I watch his hands, his beautiful, capable fingers. Scarred, as mine were before the capital erased all marks from my skin, but strong and deft. Hands that have the power to mine coal, but the precision to set a delicate snare. Hands I trust. I pause to take a drink of tea from the flask before I tell him about my homecoming.
Well, you really made a mess of things, he says.
I'm not even done, I tell him.
I've heard enough for the moment. Let's skip ahead to this plan of yours, he says.
I take a deep breath. We run away.
What?
He asks. This has actually caught him off guard. We take to the woods and make a run for it, I say. His face is almost impossible to read. Will he laugh at me, dismiss this as foolishness? I rise in agitation, preparing for an argument. You said yourself you thought that we could do it. That morning of the reaping, you said... He steps in, and I feel myself lifted off the ground. The room spins, and I have to lock my arms around Gale's neck to brace myself. He's laughing, happy. Hey, I protest, but I'm laughing too. Gale sets me down but doesn't release his hold on me.
Okay, let's run away, he says.
Really? You don't think I'm mad? You'll go with me? Some of the crushing weight begins to lift as it transfers to Gale's shoulders.
I do think you're mad, and I'll still go with you, he says.
He means it. Not only means it, but welcomes it.
We can do it. I know we can. Let's get out of here and never come back.
You're sure? I say. Because it's going to be hard with the kids and all. I don't want to get 5 miles into the woods and have you...
I'm sure. I'm completely, entirely, 100% sure.
He tilts his forehead down to rest against mine and pulls me closer. His skin, his whole being, radiates heat from being so near the fire, and I close my eyes, soaking in his warmth. I breathe in the smell of snow-dampened leather and smoke and apples, the smell of all those wintry days we shared before the games, I don't try to move away. Why should I, anyway? His voice drops to a whisper. I love you. That's why. I never see these things coming. They happen too fast. One second, you're proposing an escape plan, and the next, you're expected to deal with something like this? I come up with what must be the worst possible response. I know. It sounds terrible. Like I assume he couldn't help loving me, but that I don't feel anything in return. Gail starts to draw away, but I grab hold of him. I know, and you know what you are to me. It's not enough. He breaks my grip. Gail, I can't think about anyone that way now. All I can think about every day, every waking minute, since they drew Prim's name at the reaping, is how afraid I am. And there doesn't seem to be room for anything else. If we could get somewhere safe, maybe I could be different. I don't know. I can see him swallowing his disappointment.
So, we'll go. We'll find out.
He turns back to the fire, where the chestnuts are beginning to burn. He flips them out onto the hearth.
My mother's going to take some convincing.
I guess he's still going, anyway. But the happiness has fled, leaving an all-too-familiar strain in its place. Mine, too. I'll just have to make her see reason. Take her for a long walk. Make sure she understands we won't survive the alternative.
She'll understand.
I watched a lot of the games with her and Prim.
She won't say no to you, says Gale.
I hope not. The temperature in the house seems to have dropped 20 degrees in a matter of seconds. Hamish will be the real challenge.
Hamish? Gale abandons the chestnuts. You're not asking him to come with us.
I have to, Gale. I can't leave him and Peter because they'd...
His scowl cuts me off.
What?
I'm sorry, I didn't realize how large our party was, he snaps at me.
They tortured them to death trying to find out where I was, I say.
What about Peeta's family? They'll never come. In fact, they probably couldn't wait to inform on us, which I'm sure he's smart enough to realize.
What if he decides to stay? He asks. I try to sound indifferent, but my voice cracks. Then he stays.
You'd leave him behind? Gale asks.
To save Prim and my mother, yes, I answer. I mean, no, I'll get him to come.
And me? Would you leave me?
Gale's expression is rock hard now.
Just if, for instance, I can't convince my mother to drag 3 young kids into the wilderness in winter.
Hazel won't refuse. She'll see sense, I say.
Suppose she doesn't, Katniss. What then? He demands.
Then you have to force her, Gale. Do you think I'm making this stuff up?
My voice is rising in anger as well.
No, I don't know. Maybe the president's just manipulating you. I mean, he's throwing your wedding. You saw how the Capitol crowd reacted. I don't think he can afford to kill you or Peeta.
How's he going to get out of that one? Says Gale.
Well, with an uprising in District 8, I doubt he's spending much time choosing my wedding cake, I shout.
The instant the words are out of my mouth, I want to reclaim them. Their effect on Gale is immediate. The flush on his cheeks, the brightness of his gray eyes.
There's an uprising in 8? He says in a hushed voice.
I try to backpedal, to defuse him, as I tried to defuse the districts.
I don't know if it's really an uprising. There's unrest. People in the streets, I say.
Gale grabs my shoulders.
What did you see?
Nothing, in person. I just heard something.
As usual, it's too little, too late. I give up and tell him.
I saw something on the mayor's television. I wasn't supposed to. There was a crowd and fires, and the peacekeepers were gunning people down, but they were fighting back.
I bite my lip and struggle to continue describing the scene. Instead, I say aloud the words that have been eating me up inside.
And it's my fault, Gale. Because of what I did in the arena. If I had just killed myself with those berries, none of this would have happened. Peter could have come home and lived, and everyone else would have been safe, too.
Safe to do what?
He says in a gentler